supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Advertising has been with us for as long as someone has tried to sell something to someone else. The powers of persuasion have been a potent influence throughout human history. But in recent years, consumers have learned to avoid or block ads, which has forced big brands to devise stealthy workarounds using the tools of social media. Today on The Connection, our guest is marketing executive turned marketing critic, Mara Einstein, who joins us to talk about her new book titled Hoodwinked. She details how marketers are using the manipulative tactics that cults use to get us to buy stuff, often things we don't need and sometimes can't afford. Einstein says that as we lose trust in things like religion and civic institutions and even each other, brand algorithms are working to fill that void by creating a sense of community, a sense of connection, and by building on our emotions, most notably our feelings of anxiety. Well, we have a lot to talk about, and Mara Einstein, thanks for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a great introduction.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, we do have a lot to talk about. And let me just begin when you were one of those executives, when you were on the other side, scheming up or thinking up ads and marketing to get us to buy stuff. How did you think of us consumers?
Well, the first thing I thought of when you said that is what my boss said to me when I worked on Miller Beer, which is that we want to get people to drink so much beer that their livers bust.
Oh, that's
the job. That's to get people to consume as much as you possibly can. Now, when I worked in the industry, it was pre the internet space. So we were talking about television and print and so on. But what you want to do is find those people who are most open to your message, most willing to consume your product, and hit them with the message over and over and over again. One, to first introduce them to the product, but then once they become consumers of your product, to then get them to keep the product top of mind so you can get them to purchase over and over and over again.
And I'm curious about how, as you said, you worked in the sort of analog times of advertising. How has social media, how has the digital age essentially changed how it is that marketers view us consumers?
It's very different, because if you think about when people were watching television and would see a commercial. So if I was someone who was watching a commercial as a woman home in the middle of the day, it might be that I would see something, an ad for some kind of drug for depression, maybe making this up. But I would be sent that ad because there was an assumption about who would be the user of that target, that product.
Right.
They weren't sending it to me because it was specifically me. They were sending it to me because I was part of a demographic group. That's very different in the digital space. In the digital space, they know what you have looked at online. They can even see if your hand's trembling when you're using a mouse. So all of those things come into play. And so the information and the advertising is targeted to you more specifically as an individual than it was in the so-called legacy media, like television and magazines and so on. But what also comes into play is how the technology is created to increase our anxiety in order to keep us connected to the technology. And there's sort of two parts to that. There's how the interface works, which is that there is no set end time. So if you're on your phone and you're just sort of scrolling through your phone, there isn't a time where it says to you, nope, now it's time for you to stop.
Hmm.
When you finish a book, you've reached the end of the book, you close the book, you're done. You reach the end of the movie, you go, you're done. Now, Netflix has changed that a little bit by making us binge watch to
That's
the next
right.
thing. But if you're on your phone, there isn't a natural stop. And so you keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And that's intentional, so you will spend more time with the advertising.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. As you said, some of them know if we're nervous touching our mouse or however we're using our device. I mean, how detailed is it, is the information that they have about us as individuals?
It's very detailed, and it's also that people think that they're anonymous, and that's one of the things that particularly the folks at places like Meta and Google want you to think. But there have been a lot of studies by academics who've been able to find out, with a few key pieces of information, exactly who the people were. And reporters have done this as well, and they've been able to do this for more than a decade. And the reality is that the information that is being collected about us isn't really necessary for marketing purposes. It's, if you go to a website, one person that I interviewed said that it was they get 70,000 pieces of information when you go to a website. And it's just, how long did you spend on a page? What did you look at? What did you scroll through? Did you put something into the cart? And then all of that information gets combined with what's known as third-party data, which is information that's collected by data services. And all of that gets put together in order to target you with particular products and services. Now, yeah.
You mentioned this, and I mentioned this in my introduction, the use of anxiety to sell us products. And that just feels so counterintuitive. You would think they would want us, would want us to feel good or feel empathy or feel some kind of warm, fuzzy feeling. You're shaking your head no.
No. The whole point is for you to be at two reasons why they want you to feel anxious. One, if you are anxious, you are going to keep scrolling, right? Because one of the two things that happens is that as you become more anxious online, you get into that doom scrolling habit, right? And you're because anxiety needs release. People are looking for a way to feel better in relation to that anxiety. And so one way to do it is to keep scrolling. The other way is to purchase a product, right? And so they work in conjunction with one another. What also happens is that the way that marketing works, and this is analog, digital, anything, they have to tell us that there's something wrong with us in order for us to want to buy the product. So the more anxious they can make us feel about how we look, how we feel, not being able to find a mate, whatever it is, the more likely we are going to look for a way to release that. And going shopping in the consumer culture that we live in has become a very popular way to do that.
And I think many of us, maybe I don't think I'm the only one that sort of feels has a friendly feeling about my cell phone because it connects me to family and friends and work and things that I feel like I need to know. Obviously, a lot of other things as well. And I wonder whether, because of our relationship with our devices, whether we're more malleable because we're sort of welcoming things into our digital world.
Right. And one of the things that I talk about in explaining this to people is that think about, and I know people can't see that, but think about when you hold the phone in your hand. And particularly you're on something like TikTok, right? You are looking at another person who is looking into a camera. So you're literally holding that person in the palm of your hand. And that's a very different relationship than when you were looking at someone in a commercial on a television screen across your living room. You feel much more connected. And so that's why people talk about having parasocial relationships with people that they engage with in social media spaces, because it's and parasocial relationships, which I'm sure people know, but just to give an overall view, this is an idea that came out of the television age in the 1950s. This was first written about, where people felt like they had a personal relationship with someone that they watched on television. Now, this isn't always a bad thing, because it could be that someone sees someone on television and thinks, oh, I would love to be able to do what that person does. And that can be a very healthy thing. Where it starts to get not so healthy is when you begin to think that that person knows you or is actually your friend. So for instance, if somebody is a fan of Taylor Swift, right? And people
and there
might
are
call,
many, many around the world who are.
Who are.
Yes.
And people would even call them part of a cult, right? But the difference between having maybe a healthy parasocial relationship and a not healthy one is that you might see Taylor Swift and think, oh, you know, she's very generous. She gives money to all the cities where she goes. She takes time out to engage with her audience members and so on. But if you think that Taylor Swift wants to have a cocktail with you
right.
after she finishes her show, that's when you've crossed the line. That's when it's no longer healthy.
You write about something called the third person effect. And I think many of us will say, well, I'm a sophisticated person. I know when I'm being sold to or not. The third person effect is the belief that advertisers are influencing other people, but they're not influencing me. We feel like
right.
we're smarter than maybe we are in this digital advertising world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's so not the case. And it's always so funny for me when I see, for instance, a student saying, oh, no, I'm not affected by that. And they usually have like a Yankees cap on their head.
Right.
And it's like, no, it is finding a way into your life. And so, this is something you touched on a little bit in the introduction that I can pull out a little bit here, which is that there were different social structures in our lives that helped us to create our identity, things like what church we went to, nice. What job we had, and particularly if we had a job for decades, which people no longer do. And so what happened is that the consumer market came in to fill that void, particularly brands came in to fill that void. And so, you know, driving a Prius or walking around with an Apple computer or wearing something that has a logo on it, all of those things are communicating to other people who we are and what we believe in. And so it is impacting us. And it's not just our friends and family that are being affected by these messages.
I mean, it's a message that we are sending out into the world, depending on what kind of devices we have or what we're wearing or, you know, how the kind of eyeglasses that we might have, that those are all messages about who we are. It's part of our identity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I remember when my daughter was in school and she had, we'd switched away from Apple phones. We were using Samsung. And her friend, people said to her, oh, is your family poor? I mean, it was just... It was just the idea, like if you didn't have an iPhone, that somehow you weren't wealthy enough, which is just silly.
Well, and I wonder whether, you know, your book is largely about how marketers today now are using the tactics of cults to get us to purchase things. But I also wonder whether, you know, there are good cults and bad cults. Let's take a very short break. I'll tell you what, and we'll get back to our conversation. And again, talking with Mara Einstein, and she's got a new book. It's called Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mara Einstein about the psychological strategies that marketers are using to influence how and what we buy. And again, she's got a new book just out, and it is called Hoodwinked. And your book does have cults in the subtitle, which of course I think raises a whole host of issues and images, you know, one being Jim Jones or Scientology. Eagles fans could be could be a cult as well. People that buy Apple products, maybe that's a cult. I don't know. But it seems to me that there are, you know, the really dangerous and scary cults, and then the more benign ones, even clubs or, you know, book groups or something like that, that might have some of the same features as a cult. How do you define and describe what a cult is?
Right. What I look at is the history of the definition of cults. And in the 17th century, cults were thought of as people who venerated a person or an ideology. And it started out as religious people and ideologies. And then it became broader to not necessarily have to have a religion connected to it. But what most people think about when they think of cults are the Jim Joneses and
Right.
Charles Mansons and the Branch Davidians in that sort of 60s to 2000 period. But that was a very limited time frame for us to be thinking about cults in that way. And if you ask religious scholars, they don't talk about them as cults. They talk about them as new religious movements. And I made the decision to say, no, nobody knows what that is except for religion scholars.
Right.
What people think of is cults. And what happened is in the 2000s, the definition for cult began to shift again because of the digital space, because people were coming together around things other than these very extreme ideologies. And what we saw in the early 2000s is something known as brand communities. And these brand communities were created by a combination of consumers and the marketers who pushed these ideas. So it was community around things like Apple, right? Because you had the Apple Forum.
Sure.
And they, but that actually grew to be a cult because of the way the company is structured, because it has a walled garden around the information that you can use in conjunction with their products. So if you've ever tried to extricate yourself from Apple products, it's not an easy thing to do. And to take your music with you and to take your movies and all of that becomes much more difficult. But by about 2005, what we had is this movement, not of just brand communities, but brand cults. And Apple was certainly one. Harley Davidson was one. Jeeps, Oprah Winfrey. And that was a very limited number. There weren't a whole lot of them. But now this idea of being a brand cult has become the North Star for brands. And the reason for that is that people aren't seeing advertising in the way that they used to, or they're able to avoid seeing advertising in the way that they used to. And so what it has become incumbent upon marketers to make brands as important as possible to people, to make them as intricate to their identity as possible, in the event that they might never see another ad from that brand ever again.
And let me pick up on a couple of things. I mean, some of that is control, right? Is sort of controlling the environment or controlling what that experience is about. I would think identity is, as you mentioned, the need for community, the need for connection. But I also associate some of these more negative parts of cult behavior, which is, you know, shame and dangerous, you know, abusive behavior, things like that. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that there is, with our relationship with our stuff and with advertising, the potential for dangerous behavior?
Yes. And there's, in the book, what I talk about, I talk about the cult plus marketing continuum. And it starts with brand cults. And there's actually also a continuum within just the brand cult segment of it. Influencers that I call cult light, then influencers that become conspiracy theorists, and finally multi-level marketing.
Right.
And I'm not suggesting that you go from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. But as you move across the spectrum, what you have is an increase in anxiety and an increase in extremism. And so when I interviewed both people involved with multi-level marketing, and I spent a couple of years really getting involved with that community and talking with cult experts, and I asked, if you had to create a Venn diagram between multi-level marketing and a cult, what would it look like? And they said it would look like a circle, because they are exactly the same thing. And this goes to what you were asking about in terms of shame.
Right.
And what happens in the multi-level marketing community is somebody sees you online, pulls you into the community, uses deception, telling you that you're going to be able to work a limited amount of time, but you'll be able to have income. And then you get more and more involved with the group. You separate yourself from those people around you. So you've, you know, alienated your family and your friends, And so suddenly you're by yourself. And then when it breaks and you realize you've been caught into this consumer cult and you'd want to get out, there is so much shame around, oh my God, what did I just do? Who did I eliminate from my life? How did I get these people to spend money? And now I realize I've asked them to spend money on all these things that are terrible. It's really hard and it's really shameful. And it works the same way with cults. And they also make it difficult for you to leave because cults are very litigious. Multi-level marketing companies will say, oh, we're not going to talk to you. And they get separated from the community that have become basically their group for as long as they've been part of that company.
And an example of a multi-level marketing company would be like Herbalife, right? They sell supplements. I guess people know Tupperware, Mary Kay Cosmetics. I mean, or which is sort of selling a product or a service through people that through non-salary people. I mean, you're doing this sort of on your own and then getting other people to sign up. It's a kind of a pyramid scheme, isn't it?
It is. It is. They're legal pyramid schemes, and they're legal because it was a case that was around Amway. And this was in the 1970s. And the Amway case, they came up with these sort of fake structures to say, no, we're not really a pyramid scheme because we are selling these products. And there's an interest, a long sort of interesting story behind this, but that Amway is from Michigan and was started in Michigan. And at the time, it was just after Nixon. And so Gerald Ford was in the White House. Gerald Ford was from Michigan. He knew the creators of Amway. Their case was in front of the courts and the FTC. The FTC had won several multi-level marketing cases prior to Amway. And then the Amway case came about. They sort of had the protection of the White House, and the Amway case went through. And so these sort of legalized pyramid schemes now exist. What's really unfortunate about it is people in the MLM space really believe that if that case had not gone through, that we wouldn't be in the sort of mess that we are now in terms of multi-level marketing. And because it's not just here, it's around the world,
Oh,
because they've looked to us as the beacon for explaining what is appropriate or not appropriate in those spaces legally.
Well, and I would also think with our sort of gig-based economy, people having a lot of job insecurity, so some of these companies seem very appealing because you feel like, well, I can do this on the side. You know, I'm not going to get hurt by this, but it sounds like it's almost structured to hurt the people who are part of it and not the company itself.
Well, what's interesting, no, not at all. I mean, the way this is structured is for the people who are the salespeople are independent contractors. And as long as they're independent contractors, that protects the company, right? So whatever those independent contractors do, that doesn't fall under the auspices of the company so they can separate themselves from it, including when these people become perhaps a little more aggressive than they should be in their marketing practices. And the home company can say, oh, well, we don't do that, or we don't condone that. We have nothing to do with it. These people are independent contractors, so they can legally sort of separate themselves from that. But what's interesting about what's going on in the multi-level marketing space right now is that there are so many other ways for people to make money that this dangerous sort of pyramid scheme is starting not to be as, not looking so great in the eyes of people who are looking to make additional money. And what they're doing is creating affiliate programs, sort of in the same way that Amazon has affiliate programs. So if you create a list of products for Amazon and they create affiliate links for you, then you can make money from products that you are recommending. A lot of MLMs are looking at that. And BODi, which used to be called Beachbody, just announced like in the last couple of months that they were switching over to an affiliate model. And here you've had all these people who have been part of this multi-level marketing company who built these huge downlines, that those downlines all get eliminated when they flip to this affiliate model. And these people are not protected when the company decides that they're going to make the switch.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mara Einstein, and she's got a new book. It's titled Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use These Same Tactics as Cults. And she was at some earlier point in her career on the other side, not as a marketing critic, but as a marketing executive, also worked for a number of media organizations as well. Let me shift gears, because your book is about so many ways that we are influenced and persuaded to buy things. And I'm thinking about those influencers, those people on social media who, I'll be honest with you, I don't really follow a lot of them, but I certainly know about Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop and things like that. And she's done a very good job of, and obviously with her name, able to sort of get out there and try to influence people to buy her products. What are their skills? I mean, what makes them so attractive and successful, at least the ones that are?
That's a great question. I think it's a couple of things. One is being a really good storyteller. Some of the best storytellers out there are the ones who sort of grab you in. The other part of it is what we were talking about before in terms of the anxiety. The anxiety is connected to rage. And so there's something known as rage farming, which is that you do all you can to cultivate people's rage so that they will spend more time with you. And if you look at the way that influencers are incentivized, you can begin to see why they produce the content that they do in order to get you to stay with them. Also, the ones that are really comfortable with engaging in live action ones, like that's something I can't do. Like, I'll do a TikTok, but don't ask me to do it. Don't ask me to do a live.
Don't ask me to do any of this, but no, go ahead, Mayor.
But because you have to be doing what you're doing and engaging with people and all that kind of, and some of them are just unbelievably good at that and making people feel on the other side of the camera like they really care about them. And that's one of the things that makes it very insidious if somebody decides to pivot to being not, a little more cultish, a little more leader-like. Because one of the things that you talk about in a cult is having a charismatic leader. Right. And that's, and some influencers are totally benign. And this is the thing to be aware of. It's not that every influencer is looking to pull you in by the throat and get you to do what they want you to do. It's that they may start out being, trying to create a following and whatever, and then the power structure begins to shift, and all of a sudden it's like, no, I buy my stuff, all of this. And what becomes particularly hard for consumers, and why this deception part of this takes hold, is that it's almost impossible for the Federal Trade Commission to be able to oversee all of this, because there's just so much tonnage. There's so much advertising, and there's so many influencers. They can't keep an eye on what's going on out there all the time.
Well, I'm wondering about that. I was thinking about this, this sort of even beyond surplus, that we're kind of buried alive in messaging and advertising. I don't know how many advertisements we see, either knowingly or unknowingly, in a day, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands. I really don't know. But I wonder, too, whether, if we're talking about influencers, whether their target audience are young people, who are trying to figure out the world. They might be feeling vulnerable or insecure and feel as if whoever this person is or whatever they're selling is going to make me feel better.
That's where it gets pretty difficult to deal with. That's where I have some major issues. And I won't say the names, but I think we know of the very large influencers who have, who have influence over young people and who want to be like these other people. What also is gets pretty pernicious in all of this is this idea that doing this is easy.
Right.
Being an influencer is easy. And that's also part of this, what we're talking about before, in terms of the gig economy. The reason why the gig economy comes off as being so something that everyone should do. I remember, gosh, maybe it's 10 years ago now, all of my students talking about their side hustle. Everybody had to have a side hustle. And that was valorized. That was like, oh, this is great. Oh, you're doing all this. But you have to sit back and think, no, you shouldn't have to have a side hustle. You should be able to have an income that pays you enough money for you to have a living wage. You shouldn't have to do this. But what these companies, what the social media spaces have done is suggested to us that no, it's really easy to be an influencer. No, it's really easy to be an entrepreneur. And so you have to be doing it all the time. You have to be on every single day or at least 5 days a week. You have to be coming up with new content. And it's really hard. And there's a scholar by the name of Brooke Erin Duffy, and she calls it aspirational labor. When I love that term, aspirational labor. And it is that you're working harder and harder and harder for someone else in the hope that you will be able to get some kind of return on all that work that you have put out into the world.
About a minute before our break here, but I was also thinking about this lonely epidemic that we're dealing with, and whether, some of this marketing and advertising and influencers, whether that is in response to the fact that people feel so alone these days.
Well, I think that's what you're seeing now in terms of people being afraid of TikTok going away. Yes, it's about a space where people are engaging with each other, but that sense of community that people on that app have, that's going away. I think that's the pain that you're hearing. It's not just that a social media space is going away, it's the community is disappearing.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Mara Einstein. And again, she's got a new book we've been talking about, and it's subtitled Hoodwinked: How Marketers Use These Same Tactics as Cults. And we've been talking about multi-level marketing and influencers and how social media has really taken over the world of marketing and advertising and its impact on all of us. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, talking with Mara Einstein, and again, she's got a new book out titled Hoodwinked: How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as Cults. We are seeing, obviously, the evolution of AI, and it still feels a little, when I hear things that are clearly voiced by AI, it's pretty apparent. But I wonder, how do you think AI is going to change marketing, especially online? I mean, are we even close to imagining how it could take over?
I so hate AI. I so hate AI.
You hate
I mean, I
AI.
know we,
Fair
I know we
enough.
all have
We have to figure out how to live with this thing, right?
I know we do. Certainly, we have to figure it all out. There's a couple of things going on. We need to separate out in terms of print, voice, and video, because all of those things are working at sort of different levels right now and are at different places along the learning curve and their trajectory. So if we start with print, I think people are getting to the point where they're really recognizing when something is AI and they don't want to engage with it.
So
And
far,
you're
though, so far, wouldn't you say?
yeah well I you know if you think about it on places like LinkedIn, they were so overwhelmed with AI content that they started shifting their algorithms because they were starting to see so much of it. People weren't engaging in those spaces. When it comes to print, I think it's getting better quote unquote,
Yeah.
better in terms of fooling people. But there's still, it's still not great. Video is not good. It's really disjointed. And I'll give you a couple examples of where I think that this has not worked particularly well. If we looked at what Meta did with using fake profiles on, I guess it was Instagram. So the person that they, I mean, they did a couple of them, but one of them that they did was around a Black queer mother. And given what they've just done, that this was who they chose to do is just so hypocritical. But aside from that, if you went onto this, if you went onto the site and looked at what was on there, it was really obvious that this was all put together by AI, beyond the fact that they actually do say, you know, AI manufactured by Meta. So it is there, but it's not bannered. It's hidden under the name of the person. So they would show some pictures, and they showed pictures of the kids, and it was pretty obvious that it was AI because the background was weird and the kids in relationship to each other were weird. They had video, but the video you never saw their faces, right? So that was a real clue. And then the last thing she talks about taking her kids to this gym, and the verbiage underneath it was, "The wifey and I did this."
Dead giveaway, right?
And it's like, I don't care if you're gay or you're straight, nobody
Right.
calls their
No.
partner a wifey. It just,
Not
it's not
anymore. You're
happening.
right.
So that was a little weird.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
that didn't work. And then if you looked at something more recently, more broad, bigger, the Coca-Cola AI commercial, which was a redo of one of their previous commercials, was also a major flop that people really turned against because, again, they used people of color in the ad, but they were AI. And so you're not actually doing something like giving representation to people of color when you're not actually hiring people of color. It was also just, you know, it was so disjointed and so cold. And what you're trying to do at Christmas time is give people the warm and fuzzies. And there was nothing about that commercial that did that at all.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see just the future of AI and just how good, quote unquote, good it is going to get. Let me toss something else out, and I started thinking about this as I was reading through your book. And clearly what you're saying is that, you know, we can be hoodwinked. Deception really can live online in a very powerful way. But I'm also thinking about our politics and our, you know, political leaders and how people believe things and want to believe things that are not true. And I wonder whether there's something that we're being hoodwinked when it comes to the political world that we're living
Right.
in.
Well, two things to think about when you're talking about cults. One is a charismatic leader, and the other is an overarching worldview. And so when you talk about charismatic leaders, charisma is not something that the person has innately. I mean, I think with that, we think that that's true. It's not. It's that we imbue that person with that. And so if you look at someone like Trump isn't naturally charismatic. It's that we've had 14 years of seeing him in our living room
Right.
because of The Apprentice with this facade, because it wasn't that his boardroom looked like that. They had to create the set for that boardroom to look like that. It's nothing like that in terms of what the Trump organization is. The other aspect of this is this overarching worldview. And it's a very simplistic overarching worldview that will solve all your problems. So if you know, MAGA, Make America Great Again. Okay, but how?
Right.
But people who are connecting themselves to that idea are doing it because they're saying, you know, my egg prices are too high. I'm spending too much for housing. Why don't I have a better job? All of these things. But he's telling me that he's going to make America great again. He's not telling me how, but he's telling me he will. And if you're feeling that desperate, you're willing to believe that. And when you look at something like QAnon, One of the things that was interesting in the research for that was that they specifically targeted disenfranchised baby boomers, right? So we have this perception that, the kids all say, "Oh yeah, boomer," right? But it isn't like every it's not like every boomer had it great.
Yes,
Some
no,
people
for
did, and
sure.
some people were able to take advantage of, free education and all of that, but not everybody was. And so there's a lot of people who weren't able to take advantage of the American dream that has been sold to them. And so they're looking for someone to give them an out.
Well, and I also think with cults and maybe our political system, it's very tribal. So it creates us and them. And even in the world of advertising, it's, the people that have this product and then everyone else who does not. It is a kind of us versus them.
So the creation of in and out groups. And so what groups, the way that groups define themselves is not just by who they are, but by who they are not. And one of the things that has happened in the online space and why I can talk about marketing being like cults is that when you think about cults and the creation of these in and out groups, you think about, having a commune somewhere in Oregon, right? Where you separate everybody, where they can't engage with somebody else that is going to tell them that what the cult is teaching to them is somehow wrong. Well, we don't need to go to a commune somewhere anymore. If we're in our digital spaces, we have been so siloed to only engage with people who believe the same things that we do that we don't get that outside voice saying, you know what, maybe you don't want to think about that quite so narrowly. And I always think about this in terms actually of COVID and MAGA and QAnon. Because I think about it is like if people were getting all of this information about QAnon during COVID, and they or and if COVID wasn't going on, and they went into their job and they said, "Oh, you know what? There's this guy Q, and he drops these things, and we try to figure out what he's trying to say, and it's all this political kind of stuff." And don't you think somebody at their office would look at them and say,
What are you talking
"What are you
about?
talking about?"
Right. But alone in our bedroom or our, basement, those ideas begin to take on a sort of weird reality.
Right, and you get your confirmation from all of these other people saying to you, "Oh yeah, that's really great. That's exactly what he's saying. That's exactly what he's saying to us." And so that's what happens in these cult sort of spaces is it's not people want to say that somebody's been brainwashed. It's not that someone's been brainwashed. It's that you have been targeted because you are in a vulnerable space. This is what marketers do. It's also what cults do. And so with cults, one of the key target times for them is with college students when they first end up on campus, right? Because they don't have a support system. They don't know anybody. They want to find their community. They want to find their group. So they have someone comes up to them and says, "Oh, I have this great group of people that I think might want to interact with." And so you look and see how the people in that group interact, and you feel better because you've become part of that group. And so you continue to do those things that gets you validation from the group, right? And so while people are telling you how wonderful you are, which is all part of the cultivation and recruitment process, you continue to do those things that will get you involved in the group.
One of the things that you say in this book, and sort of connecting what we're talking about now, is that companies, yes, they want to sell us their products, but they want to sell us ideas and identity and a relationship that maybe is more important than the product itself. I underscored that because it seems so counterintuitive. Aren't they in the business to sell us stuff?
No. I mean, yes, but no.
Yes, but no.
Yes, but no. Because it's not that they want you to buy that one six pack of Budweiser. They want you to be a lifetime Budweiser purchaser. Because if you buy the one six, and I don't know what a six pack of beer goes for anymore, what, $8, whatever it is. But if you're a lifetime Budweiser drinker, you're worth like $500,000 to them.
Right.
And so it's about turning, not getting you to be like a one-time six packer. It's getting you to think of yourself as a bud drinker. And this goes to just the basics of branding. And the way that branding works is that, you know, you have the logo, sometimes you have a tagline, but you definitely have a mythology. And the mythology is the story behind the brand. And so if you think about something like Nike, it's not just these running shoes, because I'm sure there's other brands that make shoes that are just as good as Nike, but you think about it in terms of the best of athleticism. You think about it in terms of Michael Jordan, right? And who's the top of the top of the top of the top. And so that's what brands want you to do. Now, put an umbrella on top of that, if we're talking about particularly a younger generation, they want to know what are the values that that brand has. So it's not just enough that they have a mythology. It's who do you connect yourself with and what are the things that you stand for? Because if I'm going to say I'm a Budweiser drinker, then you sure as heck better believe the same things that I do. So then you get into brands like Savage by Fenty, right? Rihanna's brand. So it's not just about buying a product by her or developed by her, it's buying a product that also believes that it should be all inclusive in terms of all kinds of body sizes and capabilities and all of that sort of thing. And it started with something like Tom's Shoes, right? People might think of more broadly as Tom's Shoes or Warby Parker, where you buy a pair of glasses and another pair of glasses goes to someone in so-called third world countries, right? So almost every brand now has some sort of cause marketing connected to it. And that's why. It's because people want more depth and more connection and more value associated with the brands that they want to be connected with.
I'm looking at the clock here, a couple of more minutes, and I have a couple of more questions here. And even going back to, you know, Nike, just do it. I mean, how important are those of taglines and texts and even the rituals that we might associate with a product? How important is that for us?
The copy line doesn't exist as much as it used to, right? Taglines are not used as much as they used to be, but when they are there and they grab hold of us, they are really important. The visual, though, I mean, think about it in terms of the swoosh. All you really need to see is the swoosh. You don't need the line, right? Same thing with Apple. The Apple line used to be think different, but most people don't know that. You see the Apple logo and everything you think about it, you see in that symbology. And what's important about that, too, is that I like to think about it in terms of Gatorade. Gatorade used to be the G. And it's not even with the lightning bolt through it. It's not even the G anymore. It's just the lightning bolt. It's because of international markets. You can send a lightning bolt around the world now and everybody knows that it's Gatorade. It's really fascinating. But it's about being able to look at that and in a split second, have all of those connections that you have with the brand connected to that visual.
Final question, and you talked about the role of anxiety in getting us to buy things. And I wonder whether, and I'm a crier, limited up front. I'm a big crier and I'm an easy crier. I see those ads, I think it's for the ASPCA, of these, you know, sad dogs that are clearly been abused and neglected. And, you know, I'm ready to pull out my credit card. But how effective are they? Do you know? The ads that make us sad.
They are, but I think there's a broader aspect to it, because one of the things that I argue in the book is that economists want to say that we're living in an attention economy. Right. I say we're not living in an attention economy, we're living in an anxiety economy, because it's not just enough about making money from our eyeballs, it's about making money from our anxious emotion.
Right, which might be sort of part of our anxiety about these, you know, sad little puppy dogs that we see.
Yes.
Well, Mara, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, Mara Einstein has been our guest, and we've been talking about her brand new book. It's titled Hoodwinked, How Marketers Use the Same Tactics as cults. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Also, check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and how to sign up for our newsletter. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Again, thanks so much for joining us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?